the unknown. And so the best we could hope for was coping mechanisms. And so going into that, going into after one hard year of teaching, I found myself at Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio. Some of our listeners may be aware of this. And on the first Saturday of every month, when school's in session, they've got something called a Festival of Praise, or FOPS, as they're quaintly called there. And if I can say that. And so 1,500 to 2,000 people praising God. So this very powerful music, praise and worship, which our Protestant brothers and sisters have a great handle on. And finally, we as Catholics are kind of catching up, shall we say, in many, many quarters. And there was a phrase that was spoken that night from Isaiah 43:19 that said, "Behold, I'm doing something new. Do you not perceive it? Streams of living water are beginning to flow." And I like to use the analogy that the world we're living in is a septic tank. We are drinking from the dregs of raw sewage. And if we think about it, we have a great desire to have this quench fulfilled. And if all we see or all we think or all we perceive is a septic tank, well, there's two options then on the table. One is dehydrate and die that way, or drink from the septic tank. And if you look at the two options there, which is more attractive? Well, drinking something. Yeah, I might throw up, right? But so I had been drinking from this for so long, and what I was looking for was fresh water, was water that could quench my thirst. And what that was, as we take from Scripture and tradition, is the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit is the living water that we are called to not just drink from, we are called to dive in with everything that we are. And so I began giving God a crack, and this little stream of water, fresh water, was beginning to quench my heart. And consequently, around this time, I began also going to daily mass, receiving the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ, God incarnate, love liquefied, as I like to say, or Father, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on his name. I'll think of it in a little bit after we're off the air. And just this movement of what Jesus had done for my life, this movement to gratitude. And as we'll see, gratitude is a key aspect to helping to heal the heart, heal our minds, and open ourselves up to something better. And so I was moved to gratitude for what Christ had done for me, going to daily mass, and on a particular Wednesday, about 2 weeks later, receiving the Eucharist, moved to gratitude, I'm praying after mass, and then I realized it wasn't just Jesus that was doing this. It was the Father. It was the one who I thought had abandoned me, had walked out on me, had left me alone to die. But instead, no, he had always been there. Like that, the poem that the footprints, where I only see I've seen one set of footprints. He had been carrying me this whole time, and all he wanted me to do was climb up into his lap and be held. And we, as guys, especially, we find that very difficult, because that intimacy means we got to take our walls down, we got to take our masks off, we got to go and kind of reveal ourselves. And this also flips over to the ladies' side, because, you know, the lack of fatherhood, the lack of true, genuine masculinity, men being genuine men after the heart of Christ, is very much absent. And so I had been afraid of this my whole life, fearful, living in fear. And in that moment, I didn't have to be afraid. And all I had to do was let him love me. And I heard for the first time in my life those most important words: "You, Stephen, are my well-beloved son in whom I am well pleased." Me? Pleased with what I've done, with what all of my running? And in fact, yes, he was very pleased. And his tears are coming down my cheeks. It happened. Boom, 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 boom. These chains hit the floor. I experienced a tangible transformation of my desire to lust. This desire to want to use my sisters that I'd done so long watching videos with girlfriends, with, you know, just out and about. This desire to want to use them was transformed into a desire to want to serve them, to lay down my life. And it was real and it was tangible. And for those who think this is not possible, it is very possible. Now, you might think, okay, that's the end of the story. Great. Well, actually, it worked. It was good for about 2 to 3 months. Let's say 3 months here. Okay, there literally was internal freedom. I didn't desire anything. I had no, there was no filter on my computer, nothing hiding it. But, you know, like Peter, who took his eyes off Jesus, I sadly sink back into the septic tank. Why? Because the reason why pornography is so darn powerful, because we're dealing with chemicals in the brain that are stirred up. And if we don't deal with those and how to actually get them healed, there will not be genuine freedom. All we can hope for are coping mechanisms. And again, we'll dive into that. And so through that, I began asking, God, does this invalidate my story? Was I imagining what happened? No, it was very real. And what he needed to do was get to the root. He needed to go and pull the roots out of the heart. Because if we've been living in trauma and having been traumatized, there's healing that has to come from that. And pornography use, make no bones about it, it is a traumatic experience because it is stunting our sexual identity growth and how we use this great gift of our sexuality.
So, Steve, let me stop you there too, because I mean, you're definitely on a roll here, man. But I wanted to ask you in regards to that, and talking about the science of it. You know, as somebody who even at an early age myself was exposed to pornography, and I know in your book you have a quote from Shelley Lubin, who is actually a former porn star and now is an anti-porn activist, where she says that now the largest group viewing online pornography is ages 12 to 17, but I was 8 years old when that happened. Can you elaborate a little bit more? I mean, without kind of going off too much, but the effects of that on a young mind, especially a mind that is being formed still at such a young age.
Sure. And I would even go more precisely to say the average age of exposure is between 8 to 11 years of age. Okay. Wow. Most common, most prevalent group is 12 to 17 years of age. Okay. But 90% of those in that age group have at least been exposed to pornography. But obviously I've seen people involved as young as 6 or 5 years of age.
Wow. Okay.
So it's very, very prevalent. And so what is this doing? And if you look at a lot of the neuroscience, okay, there's a couple terms for us to talk about. One is neuroplasticity, okay? The brain has a certain way to bring things in and form our brains, okay? And all of the different, those little wrinkles, if we look at a brain scan, those are neural pathways, okay? So either those can be formed in a healthy way or they can be formed in a not healthy way. Nobody has a perfectly formed brain in a certain sense, okay? Some people, you know, and I'm not talking about brain damage necessarily, but in a certain sense, it's not too much of a stretch to say that pornography causes brain damage, okay? And maybe not a physical way that is, you know, like you'd see in a brain, in a physical malady of a section of the brain hurt. But there is evidence of changing neural pathways, different from those who do not have what's called a compulsion to pornography. And so these neural pathways form us so that we are attracted more and more. And so when you mix in the brain chemicals on this, such as dopamine, norepinephrine, estrogen for women especially, and obviously men, we have a little bit of estrogen, testosterone is a big deal, vasopressin, and others, these things create a chemical cocktail in the brain. And one of the highest charged emotional experiences we can encounter, to be frank, is that of an orgasm. Okay, mm-hmm. Where all of those chemicals are stirred up to such a high degree, but it's because of the multitude of images that we're seeing, the body is programmed to think that we need more and more and more. So you can have all the language you want, talk about all the coping mechanisms you want, that you shouldn't do this or put the computer in a public place or, you know, get an accountability, a partner or a confessor, work with them consistently. That if those are just coping mechanisms, but your limbic system, which is your more emotional world, is you've been programmed this as a survival mechanism. Well, if you pick pure reason versus pure emotion, which is going to win?
Likely the emotion.
Every single time. Yeah. So you have this notion of these, we've been programmed this way. This is the way we are designed now, this is not designed, but the way we've been programmed, this is how we perceive the world. So the way in which we interpret situations, the way in which we view other people is through the lens of a pornified world where we view people merely as objects or what their sexual availability is and the sexual desire that they might give to me. And the flip side is true on the other side. If a person doesn't give me any sexual satisfaction or perceived sexual satisfaction, then guess what? I have the right to disregard them. Is this not what is at the root of the abortion industry? which views women merely as objects because I used her in a momentary moment of lust. And instead of accepting what is the truth and beauty of that act and make the right choice, I want to disregard to the most fundamental, most innocent human being on the planet. And that's just one outcome here. The other outcome, another brain term to talk about would be that of mirror neurons. And mirror neurons are where when we watch something, we have a desire to want to integrate that into ourselves, but also to act it out. So this is where you have the false notion is, you know, what I'm doing in my private time doesn't affect anyone else. Well, the evidence scientifically speaks very highly against that, because what we're watching, you know, especially with the dopamine receptors, okay, dopamine itself is that pleasure chemical in the brain, and it's very exciting. We want more and more of it. But the more and more we stimulate that, okay, they're called receptors, and those receptors shrink. And in order to get them to kind of grow some more, you have to have more and more and more. So what excited a person first off in the beginning ceases to do so. So they need to seek out harder and harder material. Easy example would be, you know, when before the internet hit, where would we go get pornography? We would go off to the supermarket or whatever. I never, by the grace of God, never did that. But people would have to do it. It was a public way to do it. There was some public shaming involved. Now this is very private. And it's not simply the images of just a centerfold, for instance, where you have a partially naked woman there. Now you have actions are involved there between men and women, but also between women and women, men and men, multiple people here. And usually it is actions of violence against women. It's very misogynistic. Okay, this is where the quote unquote liberal crowd should be up in arms against pornography, because if we really do care about women, then we've got to take a stand against something that is dominating them in these images, in these videos. So what happens with these mirror neurons is a person with the shrinking of their dopamine needs more and more and more. Now they want to take their private viewing out into the real world. And many times they can't tell the difference. So they bring this into their bedrooms. This is why pornography is one of the highest contributing factors, if not the highest contributing factors, to divorces. This is where so much you're seeing with celebrities, right? The Harvey Weinsteins of the world, the Kevin Spaceys, all right. This is coming on has roots in pornography. And then you have the whole sex trade industry. What is fueling that? Well, people don't just grow up wanting to molest little children. No, right. It's because we've been programmed by this. So if anybody thinks that pornography is not a big deal, if not the biggest deal influencing so many of the social ills in our world, and especially within the Catholic Church, then we've got to have a wake-up call. And that's especially, I hit very hard on the neuroscience and also how this we can see this whole thing from a bird's eye view in chapters 2 and 3 of my book.
Wow.
I think really one of the important things that you mentioned there that a lot of people don't want to acknowledge is that it is, in fact, and you've mentioned it here, the compulsion, it is an addiction. And the brain's response to pornography and all things of sexual nature is the same as with heroin, crack, cocaine, and all those other hardline drugs that are out there in the mainstream. That the brain doesn't know the difference, but we still have to seek more and more and more to get that same dopamine reaction, which is the reason why people overdose. So like it's the exact same response, and that it really is something addictive. And I really appreciate the fact that you extended it beyond just pornography, that it's all sense of a sexual nature. If you look at the whole hashtag Me Too movement, it's about men who I guarantee, as you've described, have had this stuff in the background behind closed doors, and that was no longer enough, and they had to take it to the next level to get the same high they did back on day one.
Absolutely. And one point I do want to make, Cameron, I mean, you raised some excellent points. I do want to talk about the idea that I want to shy away from the term addiction, okay? And there's some scientific evidence, and I talk about it in chapter 3, that the better term is compulsion. And why is that? The reason is, in a nutshell, when people hear the term addiction, they hear once hooked, always hooked. And we have to say about this, even though a lot of people, and perhaps some of the people who are listening to this podcast right now, may think, I'm never going to be free from this. And I'm here to say that's not the fact. This is a serious issue. It is something that definitely has to be dealt with. But the healing hope and living a life that we're called to is very possible. So that's why compulsion is a much more, proactive term that we should be using.
Well, I think that actually I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that actually brings it to my next question. Is much of the industry, you know, I know Matt Fradd talks a lot about it being an addiction, and even Christopher West, Damon Owens, a lot of those TOB guys that have been there for a very long time, they all reference it as an addiction. What makes your approach and your way different from what's already out there?
Sure. And a lot of that is with the approach of wanting to heal this. Is that what you're meaning here?
Yeah.
Sure. So what we want to say is obviously to break the issue of pornography down to three problems, okay? Three main problems. Number one being a chemical compulsion issue, all the different chemicals that we talked about. And there's a stark difference. The same chemicals are stirred up in the brain during viewing of pornography as they are in marriage, but to a very different result. Whereas in marriage, there's joy, there's even healing. The term, Marvin Gaye hit it right with talking about sexual healing, if we take that to the...
Do we have to go there, Steve?
Well, I'll go full out here tonight. Yes, I'll be here all night, ladies and gentlemen, make sure to tip your waitress. So the issue of it is there certainly can be healing in the appropriate sense of that, whereas pornography does anything but heal. It steals our joy. And I think this is where so much shame and guilt is there, and why this is the 9,000-pound elephant in the room that we're just not talking about, because we're scared to death that people knew this, they're going to reject me. So we've got to deal with even just knowing about the chemicals and knowing what's going on here. Like the organization, secular organization, Fight the New Drug, highly recommend a lot of their work they're doing by exposing the truth that this is a chemical problem, on even a worse problem than the issue of cigarettes. So that would be the first thing, because just having the information opens the eyes to realize, okay, maybe there's an issue with this. Maybe I do have an issue with this, and maybe I need to do something about it. Second is going to be that of an intimacy issue, okay? We are looking for something genuine in pornified images, in those videos. We're looking for relationship. We're looking for connectivity. We're ultimately looking for union, and ultimately, if we push through, we're looking for God, okay? And so from this, though, we choose false intimacy over true intimacy. And for a vast majority of us, it's because we have no clue what true intimacy is supposed to be, what it looks like, and how do we even attain it, if it's even possible. And so from this, there's a large discussion in the vehicle. I like to say the delivery mechanism. If there's a disease here, okay, the disease is pornography. Well, the delivery mechanism for getting us the antidote is going to be St. John Paul the Great's theology of the body. And what is that? In a nutshell, it's a series of catechesis that John Paul gave when he was Pope between 1979 and 1984, going through, first and foremost, an anthropology, and what's called an adequate anthropology of what it means to be human. And so many of us have no idea why we are on the planet in the first place. And it's stemming from we don't know what our identity is. In a very quick nutshell, because we've been programmed, because apparently religion is the problem, God is the problem to the secular world, so we got to get rid of that. And if we take that mentality, this is the outcome of it. You know, I didn't come from anywhere. I don't know where I came from, so I didn't come from anywhere. And when I die, my body's just going to rot, so I'm not going anywhere. And if you don't know where you came from or where you're going, where are you? You're lost. And this is where our world is right now. We are deeply, deeply lost in search of first and foremost, of ourself. We have to come to discover the glory of who we really are. And if we really have the lens to see this, which I argue theology of the body gives us these lenses, we would have a tendency to want to genuflect in front of others, because the glory of who we are created as male and female. And not having this identity, we're going to discover a whole lot of little pleasures that happen in this world, but without the appropriate context, those pleasures become meaningless. And this is especially what I talk about in chapter 4 in my book, that we are facing a culture where we are undefining everything, and specifically five areas. One, we are of undefining love, sex, marriage, family, and the body. All these things can mean anything. If there is an essential meaning and we put something else in there, or a bunch of some other definitions that we want to throw in there, those become meaningless. And to live a meaningless life or seemingly meaningless life is to cause us to lose hope. But I want to say there is great hope. And we must come to rediscover what this is, starting with a discussion on what is the body? Who is the body? What is this all about? And it points to the greatness of who we are and the greatness of who God is. And if we believe in the incarnation, if we believe in Christmas, then we must see the importance of the body. The problem is not that we take the body too seriously, it's that we don't take it serious enough. And it's from there that we are going to discover the intimacy that we're looking here. So, and this has been a crucial factor of beginning to heal the heart for a lot of people. And that's where so many of the wounds are. That's where so much of the father wound is.